We're talking, as you remember, as I put up on the overhead, about the initial forays or initial attempts at synthetic derivatives of the opioid type structure, chemical molecules that we thought somehow looked like the phenanthrene in a 3D motif type of way. And phenylpiperidines were among the first to be put together in the early 1950s. It started with three compounds, of which the dominant one fairly quickly became the pyridine, initial trade name Demerol. Now, a couple of things about the pyridine. I mentioned the idea that it has a tendency to produce CNS excitation, maybe even tremor and convulsions due to the CNS excitatory metabolite norepinephrine. But what I neglected was to indicate to you that for the most part, opioid compounds, massive doses, can be used as not anti-epileptics, but the more general term, anti-convulsants. If you're in a pinch, you don't have an anti-convulsant, a benzodiazepine available, opioids can do the job. Got that? With the exception of mepiridine. Do not use mepiridine. Particularly if the person has a functioning liver. Okay. So understand that. That's one of the reasons I wanted to highlight that. I want a pyridine store. From a pyridine, we get these two compounds, as you remember, divinoxlate and mopiramide. And while they are not very good analgesics, they tend to have a number of the opioid types of effects, prominent among them being the GI effects, the fact that they are used as anti-diarrheals, for the most part, that is, alternatives to paregoric or tincture of opium. Divinoxylate in combination with atropine kind of do a shotgun double-barrel approach, or the more popular compound now, at least for over-the-counter use, mopiramide. And even though it is, to some degree, a narcotic analgesic, we can use it, we can put it over-the-counter, as you remember, because basically in an oral dosage form, it is not going to get across the GI tract, not going to get systemic and produce the typical euphoria that an addict would be looking for. Trying to chemically dissolve it or change it or do anything with it still doesn't get it to cross the blood-brain barrier to any great degree. And you've got to break it down before you get any significant happening there, unless you got really, really expensive, sophisticated apparatus, and you might just as well at that point make something that's a little cheaper and easier and does a better job. If you're going to be addicted, do it right. Don't play around with ammonia. The other thing, of course, is because of this, the activity, if you're going to try to get addicted to it, you better be taking all sorts of laxative and stool softener as well. The pound work. Don't even write this down. Another compound that comes out at about the same time as diphenoxylate is a compound, again, a phenylpiperazine. It doesn't stay popular too long. Vactane, ethylhepazine. It is, the reason I mention it is it is marketed as the safer, less addictive alternative to mepiridine. Yeah, it is safer, it is less addictive, it produces less respiratory depression in overdose, but the other side of the teeter-totter is it's not very effective. It produces less analgesia as well, if any at all. Point of the story, marketing. Marketing has a tendency to overstate all the time. But from ethylheptazine, we start looking at, loose relations on the phenylpiperazine family tree, a second cousin's twice removed, if you will, types of compounds. And the one that really comes to the fore and starts us down a new avenue is the compound fentanyl, which comes out in the early 1990s. Fentanyl or sublimase, again, a loose relation phenylpiperazine type of compound, is about 80 times more potent, not than piperidine, 80 times more potent than morphine. Very, very efficacious, potent compound. It has a shorter duration of action than the piperidine, which, as you remember, is a shorter duration of action than morphine. So fentanyl is about 2 hours or so, and it, because of its relatively short duration of action and the fact that you could recover from it fairly easily, it became a mainstay in minor surgeries, in those combinations of products that I talked about when I talked about general anesthesia. And as you remember, not only did it get included in a number of combinations, but one of the popular ones was a combination of fentanyl and droperidol, the antipsychotic, the psychotropic drug, in a product called Vinovar, which provides for what James started to be termed neuroleft analgesia. Neuroleft meaning we're taking consciousness out of the picture and providing some analgesia, and it's been used quite popularly for minor surgical procedures now for about 20 years. And fentanyl, of course, once it shows that it's really quite a good compound, lost it. Gets a lot of Me Too action. Fentanyl here. Sufentanil is on the market now. Alfentanil is on the market now. And there's a couple other fentanyl derivatives. Fentanyl wannabes, fentanyl Me Too drugs that basically don't have a whole lot of difference except for duration of action. So again, fentanyl comes out of the pyridine research and has become a pretty good drug. Another synthetic that came on the market fairly quickly was methadone. Now, methadone, Eli Lilly's product. Okay. Methadone produces adequate, I guess, would be the best way to put it, analgesia. It's not great. Its efficacy as analgesic is adequate. And as you might suspect from my comments with ethylheptazine, because the analgesia isn't as good, you can expect the respiratory depression tends not to be as great. Euphoria tends not to be as great. Something that I'm just going to mention, I'll say it a little bit more emphasis in a few minutes. One of the things that methadone showed that we knew about codeine, but little else at that point in time, is methadone is an excellent antitussive. And at least initially was used somewhat for intractable types of coughing. It's effective orally. discovered it over the years, it has an extended duration of action. It starts out at about 12 to 13 hours and can get all the way up to 24 hours as you start saturating binding sites with extended use. The fact it produces little euphoria on its own, the fact that it can bind to what are now known as opioid binding sites, started us to thinking, and we started utilizing it, and a study came out probably about 20 years ago now to suggest the possibility, and methadone became quite popular as a narcotic addict maintenance medication. The initial thought was not only maintenance, but maybe with the right kind of dosing schedule, we could actually wean people away from addiction. That did not prove to be as effective as we would have liked, but the idea of methadone maintenance has been very popular ever since. Methadone being administered once a day at a clinic or healthcare facility to addictive personalities to prevent the utilization of more potent, more addictive compounds. I'll have more to say about that in a few minutes as well. But who did I say made methadone? Okay. They weren't content. Methadone had its drawbacks, not the least of which was efficacy. But Lilly said, well, let's take a look at the molecule, and they started making derivatives of the methadone molecule, and one of the first things that pops up in the early 60s is a compound called propoxetine, structurally related, and it becomes a very popular analgesic compound. Dextro isomer has most of the activity. Dextropropoxetine, Lilly originally trade-named Darbon. And while Lilly would like you to think otherwise, even to this day, independent studies suggest the following. 60 milligrams of codeine, that's 1 grain, and 100 milligrams of propoxetine, 100 milligrams, and 650 milligrams of aspirin, that's 2 5-grain tablets, are equivalent in analgesic ability. First statement is you're not going to go into significant surgery on 2 aspirin tablets. So when I say equivalent in analgesic activity, I'm talking mild to moderate types of pain to get some relief. Unfortunately for the patient, Lilly didn't really understand this, didn't give a shit, I don't know. But Darbon was marketed as 65 and 32 milligram capsules. Darbon 32, Darbon 65. And if you'll remember a little earlier in the semester, it was Darbon 65 that my wife's cousin should have been getting in and around her wedding. Remember that story? Got some Phenobarb instead. Okay. Darbon 65 used quite commonly for minor to moderate pain, particularly headache, tension headache in particular, and those types of things. And 65, you can put a question mark. 32, you can say, are you kidding me? In terms of pain relief. 32 just didn't happen. morphine or Darvon with aspirin. We'll talk about aspirin next semester. It's additive in terms of the pain relief. It works a little bit different way. So we had Darvon compound 65. What's the compound? Put a little aspirin with it. Okay? Darvon compound 65. Now maybe we're in the right ballpark because we've added some pain relief on top of the Darvon compound. A further refinement was when aspirin started getting a bad name to put it, instead of aspirin, let's put it with acetaminophen. Acetaminophen also a fairly decent analgesia. It doesn't have the stomach upset that aspirin does. And other things, Darvocet, if you will, maybe becomes a popular compound. And another thing that they find is that a particular salt tends to be better absorbed, not as easily broken apart. It tends to give a little bit better blood levels, longer duration of action, and that is the, I think it's Napsylate is what the N stands for, Napsylate salt. So Darvon N becomes a popular alternative as well. And as you might suspect, Darvocet N then becomes a popular product, putting it together with acetaminophen. Equal analgesic doses of any of these propoxyphene products produce pretty much equal euphoric tendency, equal respiratory depression, which is to say if you're going to use 65 milligrams by itself, not much. But the big thing that occurs with Darvon, which is kind of interesting, and which is really what stimulates our thinking, along with the loperamide story, is the fact that there are two stereoisomers make the mirror image. Label propoxyphene. Dr. Lovstead talked about this in all. Not yet, huh? Gosh, he's about as far behind as I am. Okay. Label propoxyphene. It's a mirror image, right? I don't remember that much chemistry, but isn't that what that kind of says? Dextro and Levo. Interesting. Dextro propoxyphene is analgesic. Notice I didn't say good analgesic, but it's analgesic. Levopropoxyphene is not. Dextropropoxyphene has a pretty typical spectrum of opioid action with one major exception. It is absolutely not antitussive. Nothing. Zero. Zilch. Guess what? Levopropoxyphene is a great antitussive. And Lilly, with its cutesy names and not one to miss a beat, says, hey, this is cute. How are we going to name this? Well, it's the mirror image of Darvon. So why don't we... emphasize that. The compound gets marketed as Novrap. What is it marketed as? Antitussive. What is the big issue? It costs. that's fairly expensive when compared to codeine. And it's not that much more efficacious. It does have a lot less addictive potential, because all it is basically is antitussive. But still, the cost says, no, we're not going to use it all that much. We'll just use our codeine cough syrups or whatever. But what happens is, between this idea and the spectrum of activity between the pyridine and diphenoxylate loperamide, we start coming to the concept that, you know what, perhaps there is more than one opioid receptors, and we are just evolving the idea that, hey, there's alpha 1 and alpha 2. There's beta 1 and beta 2. So it doesn't come as a complete shock that perhaps the reason why our charts of spectrum of activity tend to have pluses all over the board. In the 35, 40 years since we started down this path, okay, at one time there were five different types of opioid receptors described. Then we cut back to four and said, no, two of these are just sub-varieties of the same receptor. And now we've cut back to three. The classic opioid receptor that we were finding in the nerve pathways, we said it's the morphine receptor, so we gave it the Greek letter mu. And you can see the list of effects that in most, catch the adjective, most animal species, the mu receptor agonism provides. We have what's now known as the kappa receptor. It wasn't always called the kappa receptor, by the way, but it has got this name now for about the last 10, 12 years. And it also provides some significant activity. The biggest thing between the mu and the kappa, well, there's two big things pharmacologically I just want to emphasize. You know, maybe there's three. I'll say three, and maybe there'll be four by the time I finish. But the big thing is, notice the mu receptor provides euphoria, whereas the kappa receptor provides, you know, we use the term dysphoria, but you might put in parentheses, lack of euphoria. The kappa receptor tends to be more concentrated spinally. And so kappa receptor agonism tends to produce what we know as mainly a spinal analgesia. That is a periapical, the gray matter, the midbrain, and the dorsal horn receptors tend to be more kappa in nature. Whereas the mu receptor tends to be more thalamic and limbic in nature. Tends to be more concentrated in the paleospinal thalamic pathway, and it's the reason why we tend to see more euphoria, more of an affective component when it is stimulated. The other thing is the mu receptor tends to be more associated with respiratory depression in the medulla, so kappa receptor agonists tend to have this plateau effect on respiratory depression, whereas mu receptors tend to just keep inducing respiratory depression. How many is that? Three. Let's stop. That's a good sum of the above, all of the above. Okay. And I hesitate to say it's kind of minor in nature at this point. It wasn't at one time. There's a third receptor out there. It's called the delta receptor. It was originally named because there was the prominent receptor in the vas deferens, of male rodents. Opioid receptors there. We found it in a lot more areas, not only in rodents, but in humans and other species as well. And it provides for a very mild analgesia, and it's usually, she's got it down here. Doesn't do much. I'll just leave it at delta receptors. Okay, we've got more than one receptor. I got to leave that for 5 minutes. Without knowing this, we had done something else while we were fooling around with the phenanthrene structure to try and produce synthetic alternatives to morphine. And one of the things that we did, as she said this year, you know what N allele says? We put an allele group on a nitrogen in a particular point of the phenanthrene ring, N allele. And as soon as we did that, we found a compound that had high affinity and little or no efficacy. That is a good antagonist, competitive. The first N allele was on morphine itself. And again, our nomenclature kind of cutesy, okay, it's N-allelomorphine, so let's call it nalorphine. Trade name here was nalorine. And as you might suspect, its major utilization was to combat acute overdoses of narcotic drugs. Okay. Not effective orally. That N allele group can be knocked off fairly easily. Fairly short duration of action. 90 minutes, 2 hours. Dr. Love said would probably know this better than I would suspect, again, because it's so easily metabolized, even from a parental point of view. She knows more about that than I. But a short duration of action, my concern is that because of a short duration of action, we kill some people. We would detox them, put them in the recovery room, and forget about them. And the antagonist would wear off, and they'd be right back in the soup again on their journey through narcotic Never Never Land. Some of them will never return. We found that out the hard way. The other thing about narcotic antagonists, okay, is that, I guess I'll demo a little bit. Okay, so I've got a... I've got a bunny rabbit here. Okay? Nice little bunny. And what I've done to this rabbit is I have put a catheter in the marginal ear vein. And we actually did this experiment when I was a grad student with part of PCOL lab. So, yeah, I can do that. So we've got this little tube in the ear vein, and the bunny's, looking at me, and its whiskers are going to say, I know what's coming. And you take a syringe full of morphine or mepiridine, and you start introducing it. Okay? And the whiskers go slower and slower, and the breathing starts slowing down, the bunny turns over, I keep feeding it the morphine. And the bunny starts turning blue. at which point some of the more skittish in the audience are breathing deeply, right? One or two respirations a minute. Now, as opposed to Tim, I can't go, "Breathe, bunny." Bunny doesn't understand English. It's a Czech bunny. That's our way. But anyhow, what happens is I remove the syringe of morphine. I put in an alloy. I start feeding it. That's how quick the bunny is back to normal. Opioid antagonists are the most dramatic, the most, oh, by the way, most dramatic antagonists we have available. Not like that shit atropine where you have to put it in first and it takes 4 or 5 minutes to set up on the muscarinic receptor. We can give the morphine a head start. That fast. The bunny's up. Whiskers are going pink instead of blue. But the point is, remember I talked a little bit about what we think narcotic addiction is all about in terms of receptors and making enkephalin. And that withdrawal is all about when you withdraw the drug, you have to make some more enkephalin. And it takes a period of time, usually about 72 hours, for a narcotic addict to go through withdrawal. Well, guess what I've just done with my antidote? Not only have I antagonized the overdose, but I've taken them through withdrawal that fast. Narcotic opioid withdrawal is not, I repeat for emphasis, is not life-threatening. It's not pleasant, but it's not life-threatening. Barbiturate withdrawal, general depressant withdrawal, is life-threatening. Narcotic generally is not. But if you take them through it in a fraction of a second, guess what? It's life-threatening, big time. And so we have to be very careful with the utilization of these compounds in the cases of acute overdose. You can't just go into an apartment building and say, "Oh, yeah, I can do that." No, you've got to have some fairly significant equipment around in case things happen. Okay? Nalene was the first one. Now, the interesting thing about Nalene was that, believe it or not, people would be coming in for Nalene every couple of months or a couple of weeks or whatever. We give them another dose, and they started getting addicted to it. Which said, "Well, son of a gun, maybe the stuff is not a pure antagonist." And we found out, yes, it did have some agonist ability at kappa receptors particularly. And so Nalene became known as a partial agonist. Did I give you that definition in drug action? Something with both agonist and antagonist qualities? And we started coming up with alternatives, and probably the first one to come down was naloxone or Narcan. Okay. Another one that's used quite commonly is naltrexone. To be honest with you, I have forgotten its trade name. It's like Trexone. Trexan or something like that. Don't remember what it is on the paper. Something like Trexan. I'll do this. An R with a question mark. How's that? Two commonly used compounds as antagonists, and these are would call pure antagonists. All three receptors, all three good affinity, no efficacy, antagonism. Okay? Naloxone, naltrexone. Naloxone, just one point. It's ineffective orally. Significant first pass metabolism. And that's made it kind of nice. I'm going to end up talking about some newer synthetic products, among them a compound by the name of pentazocine, or Paulin. Dr. Wilson mentioned that yet. Paulin comes on the market in the mid to late 70s. And while it's originally marketed as not having any abuse quality, this story plays over and over again by the way over the last 50 years. We get a new compound, what's it initially marketed as? Less addictive, less abuse, less respiratory depression. And then after some extensive use, we find, well, maybe it's less, but it's not zero. Tolan gets abused. And it's the prototype then of a combination. Tolan can be used orally, and has a seed. And if you took the original Tolan preparation and did some basic extraction chemistry, you could get a pretty good dose of Tolan out. Okay? Not too bad. And addicts would do that, and then they would inject it rather than use it orally. But what the manufacturer did when we figured out what we could do is they added naloxone to the product, so the compound becomes Tolan NX. Okay? You take it orally, it's still effective, because what did I just say about the naloxone? It's going to be metabolized before it gets systemic, so it's not going to block. But the thing is, now, if you're going to extract the Tolan into a parenteral product, you've got to get rid of the naloxone. Because if you inject naloxone, it's going to block all the receptor sites for your Tolan. Everybody follow where I'm going? And to extract the naloxone from the pentazocine takes a lot of sophisticated chemistry and very expensive apparatus. So again, it economically doesn't make sense to try and deal with Tolan and X. And there are a couple of other products now, oral products, that use naloxone to discourage addictive behavior. So, antagonists. I talked about pentazocine. Pentazocine, you'll notice, is the first compound that we have that is an agonist mainly at the kappa receptor. It's at best a partial agonist, I would guess is probably closer to the truth rather than a pure antagonist, at the mu receptor. And in fact, while I don't think it's on the sheet here, the big thing about pentazocine is that a person who is addicted to pentazocine can be kept addicted with nalorphine and vice versa. Naline and pentazocine will substitute for each other to some degree. That is, prevent withdrawal. But the big thing about pentazocine is that it becomes the prototype for a new, how would I say it? Class is wrong. I don't want to talk to Mr. Jones. We have to develop a new way of looking at these compounds. And it's phentasicine that gets us to change the definition to the idea that opioids are now compounds that show agonist activity at one or more opioid receptors. Remember that definition? Okay. And we create a new terminology. And the terminology is that these compounds are called mixed opioid agonists. Not partial agonists, but mixed agonists. Which suggests that they can have one of three activities at any one of the three opioid receptors. But that they are going to be at least a partial agonist at one. Those three activities are, they can be a full agonist, they can be a partial agonist, or they can be an antagonist at any of the three opioid receptors. And it was when we started thinking in these concepts, and again, phentasicine was the compound that pretty much got us to thinking that way, that we started understanding the idea of that variability within spectrum of activity based on the actions of the various opioid receptors. We could understand now why we would see various pluses for various compounds. It is actions at various opioid receptors, whether it be agonist, partial agonist, or antagonist, that produces the reason why diamonoxylate and loperamide are not acting exactly like meperidine. It's the reason behind why levopropoxyphene is different from dextropropoxyphene. And both are different to some degree than methadone. It's all about this mixed picture. And as you might suspect, we have, since the late 70s, been dealing with the manufacture of compounds that provide as much agonist activity here and as little. We'd like these to be blank. Well, not those. These two would be blank. Or maybe antagonist. Unless we've got a person that's highly addictive, in which case we would like this one to be as agonist and this one to be as blank as possible. Agonist, agonist, agonist. Now, just in small print, the definition, opioid, a compound that provides agonist activity at one or more of the various opioid receptors. Small print, we still include naloxone and naltrexone. We call them opioids. By the classic of the definition, are they? No, because they're pure antagonists. But we do it anyway. Okay. Now, some of the newer compounds are up here. Buprenorphine, I'd like to talk more about, that next semester. Like methadone, it's found its best utilization in maintenance programs at this point. The big thing about nalbuprenorphine, that I want to just mention is that it tends to be a prodrug. Tends to have better activity if you got a good liver functioning. think that's as far as I want to go. I talk about butorphanol, nalbuphine. I'll start with pentazocine. We'll talk a little bit about butorphanol as well.